That which touches me most is that I had a chance to work with people, passing on to others that which was passed on to me.
That's Bernice Reagan Johnson, or Johnson Reagan, actually, and Sweet Honey in the Rock with Ella's Song, inspired by the fiery human rights activist Ella Baker. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lee. It is Tuesday, November the 25th, and Ferguson, Missouri remains a tinderbox of rage and raw emotion after a grand jury announced last night that it found no reason to bring charges against Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot and killed Michael Brown on August 9th. The grand jury's decision touched off violent reaction in several areas of the city, while President Obama and Brown's parents called for calm. Information is sketchy still, but some 25 buildings in Ferguson were set ablaze overnight and several businesses looted. 82 people, likely more, were arrested, and hospitals have reported 13 injured, including two with gunshot wounds. Lead Stories listeners were prepared for the outcome, having been warned as early as August the 19th, just as the grand jury began its probe into this case, that the case actually was already on the wrong track. Attorney at Law Alton Maddox Jr., who has been our legal expert and guide throughout this whole process, analyzes the prosecutorial crime scene, as it were, and discusses today why the grand jury's decision should not be the final word on Wilson's culpability. And thank you so much, Alton, for being with us once again.
Again, Eutrice, thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, what do you make of the decision? Of course, we discussed this as inevitable, and so here we are with the inevitable.
Well, one, I'd like to say from the beginning, for those people who are pessimistic, that there have always been people who said that the system doesn't work. And there are probably people in your audience now listening and holding on to their pocketbooks and saying that the system doesn't work. I have not been one of those persons who ever said that. I have always believed that the system works if there's somebody who knows how to work the system. And so the question today is whether we want to put our best foot forward and put somebody in front who knows how to work the system, or do we want to continue to remain as social parasites? Just simple as that. Because it's very obvious there is a national shoot-to-kill policy that is going on. And certainly anybody who has a child or a relative or a friend or a neighbor or whoever the case might be, and who don't want to lose that person, has to be ready to stand guard, to do whatever is necessary to stop this national shoot-to-kill policy. There's no vested interest in white supremacists in not executing that policy now because of the fact that we are off the plantation. We are no longer, quote, chattel slaves. And so any harm that is done to any of us will not inure to the slave master. I'll just simply say that from the beginning, I have certainly seen all of this. I have spent my time and money over the last 3 years meeting many times every month at the Cotton Club, mostly at my expense because people did not want to come out or they did not want to invest, even though it was free. And the only thing you had to do is make whatever donation you wanted to do. And some people only made $1 or $2 or $3 and ate a $15 breakfast, and I had to pay the bill. You know, I have continued to write on this. I've continued to try to educate our community, which is necessary in order to sustain a struggle. You have to have education first. Nothing works without that. There are too many people who have been in accord with that. I've certainly have had the opportunity to meet people such as Kwame Ture, who said you must educate. Frederick Douglass, who has believed that. Wilbur Taylor, who gave me an opportunity for more than a decade to write an article in the Amsterdam News, who felt like my voice had to be heard, and a number of other people. So, you know, there's nothing about this other than what we should do today and the days following today is to have an examination of this process first before we get into the mechanics of what the grand jury may have done. Because if you have an unfair process, you're going to get an unfair result. And this is what has to be examined first. And so I'm certainly prepared to look at this and to pinpoint exactly what went wrong, because among other things, is no question about it. And this is where I get concerned when your enemy says that you are the only person who know how to win. The question is, how are you doing it? And that seems to have not in any way connected any dots with anybody in our community as to who should actually be engaged in this process.
Well, that brings me straight to the question. We have here a grand jury operating under rather, well, of course, in secret, but other, we can tell from what we learned about the witnesses being called, including the police officer himself, Darren Wilson. The grand jury, it is widely viewed now. I'm seeing more and more people commenting about the unusual nature of this grand jury and the unusual function it was made to fulfill. And now people are beginning, I'm seeing some evidence of it, they're beginning to question exactly what was the purpose of this grand jury and what, how could the prosecutor in this case be allowed essentially this wide berth to put together a kind of a hybrid grand jury, a function that seemed to encompass a departmental hearing, a regular trial, the normal functions of a grand jury, and even, you know, a kind of an expedition to elicit new information, a fact-finding committee, if you will. So what is your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction to that is this, and I somewhat have a different take on my reaction, because everything that I say and do is steeped into the sayings of our ancestors. I don't take a position on any matter that is in front of me without consulting the ancestors first. And this is the reason why when people say, well, how did he win this case? How did he win that case? I didn't win any of those cases. The ancestors won those cases. And so when you start here, you have to start with what Charles Hamilton Houston said. And that is this, is that black lawyers must be in the vanguard of the legal revolution. Black lawyers must be in the vanguard of the legal revolution. The last time I checked, there was no black lawyers present at all. Because if they were present, and I have a website here where I can document all of this because I put it on the website. So, you know, it's not like I'm talking to you now. This is information that's been there for quite a while to try to explain to people what they should be doing, given the fact that I don't have an organization or a community that is willing to stop the judicial bullying that is going on against me. So therefore, I wrote in there that when you have a matter in which the grand jury is operating under martial law, the first thing that you have to do is to go to court to get a temporary restraining order asking for a preliminary and productive relief with respect to that. Because the answer is very obvious. I mean, people forget what Nixon did. Nixon declared a state of emergency, which means a martial law. So therefore, at the moment that he said that, all constitutional rights were suspended. And
you're referring to Jay Nixon, not Richard. Jay Nixon, the governor of Missouri.
Jay Nixon, right? Okay. Well, maybe I'm mixing apples with oranges. but the reality of it is that Jay Nixon declared martial law that suspended all constitutional rights. Now, there is a lawyer in our community who is one of our ancestors now, Scipio Africanus Jones, a very prominent lawyer in Arkansas. And when Arkansas was subjected to the Elaine Rebellion in Arkansas, several persons were killed. In addition to them being killed, others were arrested, and eventually several of them had to be tried. Initially, in that case, the persons who were tried were initially tried by a white lawyer, particularly at the behest of W.E.B. Du Bois. And at some point, this white lawyer died, and Scipio Africanus Jones came involved in the case and took the case to summation and verdict. All of the young men got convicted. At that particular point, W.B. Du Bois said, well, we can't have Scipio Africanus Jones going into the Supreme Court because we need a white lawyer to do that. And so eventually, Jones had to step aside, and at that particular time, the Supreme Court got the case, and they reversed all of the convictions. And they made a note of saying that they had never seen any lawyer before the U.S. Supreme Court perfect the trial record in the way that Scipio Africanus Jones did. And that it was absolutely amazing how meticulous he was at trial in representing those young men. And the inescapable conclusion was that their convictions had to be reversed. So what we're saying here, we're talking about a tradition of real lawyers. What we see in Ferguson today is a bunch of imposters. They're ambulance chasers. They have nothing to do with the way the law works. And so, therefore, by failing to go into court, you are unable to put the judicial system in Missouri on the spot. And that was where I felt like that was the last straw in this particular case.
Well, today, the lawyers and the Reverend Al Sharpton are furiously issuing news releases about a call now for the federal government to step in and for federal inquiry to pick up from where this state grand jury left off. However, one could argue that this was, in fact, a missed opportunity, whether by omission or by commission. They decided, Sharpton and the lawyers, decided that they were not going to press for a special prosecutor in this case, and they were not going to confront the state when they certainly could have to make sure that the case was on the right track.
Well, you know, you've been very kind in saying that they failed to front the state. What they did was punked out. And so, therefore, the opportunity for them to have gotten a special prosecutor came and went. because they punked out. And I think that people have to write them and ask both Crump, Darryl Parks, and Gray, Attorney Gray, and Sharpton, how is it that one lawyer in two separate cases, both of them very high profile, with the state opposing him, how can he go in and get two separate special prosecutors? And then after that, how can he go in after a grand jury refused to indict in the Michael Stewart case, and the prosecutor there was the impressive, in quotation marks, influential Robert Morgenthau, who had opposed to any grand jury at all? How can a lawyer go in after the grand jury the first time refused to indict, and this lawyer go back in and get the grand jury to indict the second time and force the state to take those 11 defendants all the way to trial and to jury? I mean, so you know what I'm saying is there is legal precedent. I'm talking about myself, my own experience, and what happened. So for somebody to, as the media is doing now, and this is why your program is so important, the media is acting as though, well, it's one and done. It has never been one and done. You have the Fifth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment is not applicable to grand jury proceedings, and therefore, if one grand jury does not indict, then you go to a second grand jury. If the second grand jury doesn't indict, you go to the third grand jury. You go to the fourth grand jury, you go to the fifth, you go to as many times you get somebody to indict this particular person. And so we're not hearing that, because the other side of the coin is that when a lawyer, when a prosecutor rather, get an indictment, go to trial, the case end up with a hung jury, the prosecutor turns right back around and prosecute a second time. Prosecute a third time, prosecute a fourth time, prosecute as many times as it would take for him to get a conviction. So my point is, what are we talking about? The federal government, we haven't even finished with the state yet.
Precisely.
And we already are raising our white flags and running for the tall grass.
Now, in order for this to happen, they should have signaled by now. First thing this morning, a whole bunch of papers should have been in the court somewhere, mm-hmm. saying that we insist that this matter be pursued again.
Absolutely. That's
but it's
exactly
not happening.
What they were supposed to do, because what you do is, and that's why I said that you have to know how to make the system work. You just can't sit and say, well, the system doesn't work. Well, it won't work if you don't do anything. It will work if you put your foot down and let the other side know you're not dealing with boys here. You're dealing with a man, all right? And as
and the,
a man,
the thing is,
get your butt back into that grand jury and indict this cop or else. That's how you talk to them. That's how I talk to them. I mean, so, you know, the point is to sit here and listen to Benny Crump and Sharpton and Gray and all these other chumps, you know, talk about all of this nonsense when we need a man to do a man's job.
This is not, the outcome was not unanticipated.
Right.
And in any event, there was a lot of time. This grand jury had been meeting for 3 months. So there was ample time to expect, well, look, if there's an indictment, well, we don't have to worry about that. But in the event there is no indictment, what is our backup plan? What is plan B? They opted out of this situation from the word go. It is as if they said, our interest here, and we have to be really clear about the connection of these decisions that they had made, Sharpton and the lawyers, and the consequence that we are seeing unfolding now.
Mm-hmm.
There is a direct link to their unwillingness or inability to proceed with some degree of authority on this as people with some expertise here. This is not Sharpton's first time around the block on this kind of case. And even if it were, one would assume that as a lawyer, even if this were your brand new first case, what all lawyers would do is check to see what the precedence has been in cases like this. What typical approach do you take?
Right.
But
absolutely.
We saw none of that.
No, you haven't seen any of this, and the reason why you haven't seen any of this because they were only looking for the excuse to raise the white flag and run. There was never intention to fight these people at all. You can't send boys to do a man's job. People in New York need to understand that as we're dealing with Gurley now, as we're dealing with order. You can't send boys or girls to do a man's job. I don't know how much you have to tell somebody that. You have to send a real man to do a real man's job. And these chumps are not capable of doing that. I mean, I can't be no nicer than them and just simply call it for the way I see it. This is a very simple matter. It does not take that much in order to get a grand jury to indict. Probable cause was already established. We already had eyewitness testimony. We already had a medical examiner's report. And we also must recognize it is the responsibility of a prosecutor to do justice. And when a suspect has erased the opportunity for the victim to speak, the prosecution has to stand forward and speak for that suspect. I mean, speak for that victim. I mean, so, you know, in this situation, that's what prosecutors do. You go and kill somebody, the prosecutor step forward and say, wait a minute, you haven't gotten away with this now just because you just killed somebody. You know, you still got to deal with the state, and the state is going to substitute for the victim. And instead of the victim speaking, the state is going to speak for the victim. I mean, so, you know, this is a situation we don't have here. And in the middle of all of that, the only thing that we have is for these ambulance chasers to start talking about getting some chump change and taking a flight out of St. Louis.
The attack that the prosecuting attorney, Bob McCullough, in Ferguson took is now people are saying how unusual it is. And his tact was, I am just going to put all of the evidence before the grand jury, and it will be up to them, because this is what assures the impartiality of the grand jury. I'm not coming into the grand jury with any predetermined outcome or anything like that. I'm just going to put all of the evidence before them, and it will be up to them to decide what charges, if any, they will vote against the defendant, if you will, Darren Wilson.
And that's exactly what
the prosecutor
did
in taking
but
this tact.
This is what a prosecutor would not do, and exactly. That is say, I'm going to create a runaway grand jury, and I'm going to allow this runaway grand jury to decide this process any way it chooses to do so. This is what he did. He created a runaway grand jury. He created a grand jury that had no instructions, no boundaries, no fences at all. They were willing to do and capable of doing whatever they had to do, and there was no real scrutiny of the process. First of all, there should have been a challenge to the array of the grand jury. That's the first thing you do, to challenge the array. That's what we did in Tawana Brawley. People forget about it. You know, people listen to what people say. They don't look at what the record shows. The record shows that we challenged Bob Abrams and said, look here, we challenged the process. What Bob Abrams said in return was, well, I'm going to let the selection of this grand jury be public. That was the first time ever in the history of New York that a grand jury has been subject to a public selection process. That did not happen in Missouri, and that's just one of the real problems of not having legal representation. So, you know, I can understand a lot of young people being mad, but, you know, you got to ultimately say, well, to the grown folks, well, if you had somebody who could have taken this case and really represented us, then why didn't you stand up and do that? But you can't turn around and allow some boys to do a man's job, and now you all of a sudden you're going to claim that McCullough is some kind of bully. And the reason why he is a bully is because nobody was standing up to him in the first place. That's why he's a bully. He wouldn't be a bully if there was a man there to deal with him. And that's what the question that comes to our community. Are we to the point now where we're all nothing but boys? If we are more than boys, then we need to find a man to do a man's job.
Well, we have here, just the same, we have no record of any questioning of how this whole process was working. I'm talking by that in terms of a legal challenge. There are no papers that say we have a problem with the constitution of this grand jury. We have a problem with the conduct of this grand jury under the prosecuting attorney. We have a problem with the composition of the grand jury. We have a problem with the approach that this prosecuting attorney is taking. We are not clear as to what exactly this grand jury's job is. In taking this tack,
because they were given no instructions.
Not only that. It's still a one-sided event. If he is going to lay the information out and the evidence, well, of course, where's the evidence that says to the opposite, that might have basically ameliorated or mitigated the evidence that was in fact presented that said that it, speaking to the point that you made about the prosecutor, therefore, should be speaking in the interest of Michael Brown. Where is the evidence that spoke to the interests of Michael Brown? If he's just going to lay out all the information like that.
Yeah, right, because that's not how grand juries work. Grand juries are dominated by prosecutors who make sure that it is their show, and at the end of the day, they get a conviction, not a conviction, but an indictment. That's the way that grand juries operate. No self-respecting prosecutor at the end of the day is going to walk away and say, well, I'm sorry, I couldn't get an indictment here. Well, you're sorry because of the fact that you had no opposition at all. It was your show, and you couldn't get an indictment out of your show. Something got to be wrong. There's a reason why people say, well, a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. First of all, it's his show. Why can't he indict a ham sandwich? That's not difficult to do.
Is this a blatant example of either prosecutorial misconduct or malfeasance?
Well, it's certainly a combination of both, if you really want to be direct that about it, because first of all, there's a line of cases in which at one point in the 18th century, it could be argued that you did not have to instruct a jury or a grand jury at all. And that was a case called Georgia versus Brelford. It went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, in which that was the ruling. But 100 years later, and I find it rather curious in terms of its timing, but 100 years later, it said, well, jury notification is no longer permitted. Well, the only people that were going before juries now were black folks. And so now, all of a sudden, the rules change. And so as a result of the changed rules, the court said, well, you got to give the jury some instructions. Here's a prosecutor here that said, well, I just totally deviated from that. And so he said, well, I don't have to give any instructions, and I didn't give any instructions, and I just simply dumped all of the information in the grand jury's lap. Well, if that was going on, some lawyer would have said, wait a minute, you can't do that. I mean, just the way that you have exterminated the judicial process at all warrants Michael Brown getting a second bite at the apple, because the prosecutor's already told you that I simply just eliminate the whole process. Now, so you're saying now that since you have eliminated the process, there's nothing else we can do but put our tail between our behind and run home? I mean, that's crazy.
What happens if you were handling this case, let's say, at this point? I know it would not have gotten to this point, but let's say you're picking up the case at the point it is right now. What would you do?
Well, the good thing about me is, Eutrice, for those who want to review what I would do, it's already online, www.reinstatealtermatics.com. It's already online. My whole strategy in terms of how do you put this man behind bars is already there. And so my first recognition would be the fact that it is not double jeopardy. It does not apply in this case, and we have to put Plan B into operation. I have Plan B on the website, www.reinstatealtermatics.com. So it's not like I'm just saying what, you know, some people may just want to hear me say, but I'm saying what the facts are. The facts are is that this young man in no way in the world should have to have left this world without a people being responsible enough to stand up on his behalf and to get justice on his behalf, rather than to allow Darren Wilson to marry and not be on his honeymoon and enjoying himself while he's just taking a black life. We must remember one thing. We say this, we put this on signs, but we don't mean it. Black life is not cheap. That's what America has to understand. That's what the judicial system has to understand. That was my approach in every case that I ever taken. Black life is not cheap. All right, you will pay a price for the life you just taken, all right, or the woman that you just raped. It's not cheap. And until we can find some other people who adopt that attitude, we're going to always be involved in this process. But there's a process here where I talk about the things that have to be done. But immediately it would start with recognizing the fact that we got to go into round two. And in round two, we will get this indictment and we can move on from there. And that's what our community got to be committed to doing. And when I say our community, I mean everybody, because this is a class action. A class action means that this is an action that is being taken against a class of people. And the class of people that we're talking about is all descendants of enslaved Africans. That's the class of people that we're talking about. And, you know, the thing that we have missed here in all of this, because there are a lot of things that have happened. I just said that we can be here for a while talking about this whole process. But you see, after Governor Nixon did what he did, brought in the National Guard, declared martial law and all of that, the next question that we have to ask ourselves, I know it's painful for somebody to ask it because we have such a love affair with this man, but we have to ask, what was the responsibility of President Obama in all of this? And I will submit to you that President Obama sold us a bill of goods. And so, at the meantime, while he was trying to line up the Latino vote, he threw us to the wolves. And so he can now find it in his soul to protect the rights of immigrants who are not citizens, but he can't do nothing for us who are citizens. And that's a real contradiction. For you to say, well, I can take an executive order for Latinos who are not citizens. I mean, when we talk about those who are not here as citizens. But on the other hand, all of these descendants of enslaved Africans who have been here all along, I can't do nothing for them. Well, that's a bunch of crap. And that question needs to be raised to him. Why can't you? And this is what I will submit, what we saw. When Eric Holder came to Ferguson, he did not come to Ferguson to do anything other than to smoke a peace pipe with those Confederate members of the United States. That's what that was about. Because what we saw in his coming to Ferguson was the federal government surrendering federalism to states' rights. That's what we saw. We saw the federal government surrender federalism to state rights. And now what he made plain to the people of Missouri is that the federal government is not going to do anything to protect the rights of these blacks. That has to be an obligation that you in Missouri can take if you feel necessary. And you know who was really laughing at all of this? Chief Justice Roger Taney. Because that made his day. The fact that now states' rights control our destiny and our fate can only go and endure to the benefit of Chief Justice Roger Taney, who said that no Negro has any rights that a white man is bound to respect.
Who initiates and who compels this round two to happen?
Well, I think the what needs to understand in round two, obviously you got to have an argument before you can get off of home plate. And the argument for those who on CNN right now and all of those who are on MSNBC and all of those who are on all the networks who are saying, well, it's nothing that the family can do now. Maybe file a civil suit. Have some commission to investigate this case, to remind them of one case, and I believe you know this case very well, and that is the case of Yanko Rosenbaum, who was a Jew who he claimed, or the government claimed, was murdered by Limerick Nelson, a person of African ancestry. Limerick Nelson had a trial and was acquitted. So he was indicted. He went to trial and he was acquitted. And the Jewish community was totally dissatisfied with that result. And they then turned around and demanded that Limerick Nelson be tried again, this time in federal court. The problem with that was this. The federal courts have no jurisdiction over a matter like this because, first of all, the civil rights laws were enacted for the benefit of descendants of enslaved Africans. It was not enacted for the benefit of Jews. So, you know, you're dealing with a situation now where you're talking about using a civil rights statute, which is only designed for us, and now you're going to use it against a descendant of enslaved Africans. Limerick Nelson was one of us. Now you're going to use a statute against us. And secondly, when you conduct the investigation, you know that it was the hospital and not Limerick Nelson that caused the death, and that the Jewish community went and settled the case with the hospital, got the money from the hospital, and then turned around and put Limerick Nelson behind bars. Now explain that.
I remember the case very, very well.
So, and that's what and those are the kinds of things that we got to go back to in terms of dealing with this. Now, no black selected official going to make that argument. Al Sharpton's not going to make that argument. So the question becomes, who's going to make that argument? Who is the black community going to empower to make that argument on behalf of the black community? And to let the other side know, this person is representing us, and he's making this argument, and we want some answers.
So we still are stuck with this question about what, therefore, should be the role of, I mean, Sharpton is clear. They're having all kinds of news conferences now everybody's, you know, doing a great CYA, you know, covering their butts, because what has happened is living proof and testimony of their ineffectiveness and the fact that the community is not paying attention to them. The community Absolutely. Is operating on a whole different level of consciousness about what's going on here. And they have, by their actions, they also are rejecting the established leadership. They're saying, whatever it is that you guys are doing, I mean, we may not be well-versed in all of the details, but we know for sure that you are not connected to us, you're not representing us and our interests.
Well, and you're absolutely right, because just at 12 o'clock today, we're not talking about tomorrow or yesterday, at noontime today, Sharpton and Crump and others held a press conference, and the black community out in Missouri ran them off of the platform. I mean, so it's very clear that people began to understand that Al Sharpton has no influence, no power, no anything, and that he's only running a pacification program for white supremacists. But in the meantime, if he has to answer any questions, the first thing he needs to answer is, where was he last night? Now, if he's going to be the leader, then you got to be present. You can't be AWOL, the leader, and then turn back today and hold a press conference denouncing the prosecutor that you were afraid to confront in the first place.
Mm-hmm. No question about that. I want to come back to your discussion about the role of the president here.
Mm-hmm.
What role could he possibly actually be playing at this time? Other than, of course, he's done the requisite thing of calling for peace and calm and whatnot. But what could the president have done, or what could he be doing in this scenario here?
Well, he could be doing the same thing that Eisenhower did in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he could be doing the same thing that President John Kennedy did at the University of Alabama. And that was, if it was necessary to call in the National Guard, he could have put them under his thumb and made sure that they did not do anything inappropriate unless until he felt the necessity of doing that. Because that's what he has the authority to do, is to nationalize the National Guard if he felt it was appropriate. If he felt it wasn't appropriate, he could simply say, hey, I'm nationalizing you so that Nixon has nothing to do in this case, and I'm instructing the jury to dismiss the fact that he has called for a martial law, because martial law is not appropriate here. The only thing that these person have done was demanded that they be given the opportunity to exercise their First Amendment rights. And that has never been a basis for the suspension of constitutional rights, the mere fact that somebody want to exercise their rights. And so he could have done that right from the beginning. He did not do that. On the other hand, he could have also brought in the federal government and said, look, you have tainted this process. I am going to get an injunction against the state continuing this farce, and we're going to redo this again.
And now with this looming investigation, and hopefully we would see rather soon what Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, what comes of his investigation, the idea being that even if anything comes of it, it will be on the civil rights end. Would that, in your view, include possible criminal prosecution?
No, it won't include anything, because he's already gone to Missouri and already indicated to the people in Missouri, or the public officials in Missouri, that this administration is respecting states' rights. It's not respecting anything but states' rights. We're not dealing with federalism here. We're not going to try to enforce federalism, and we're going to honor the compromise of 1877. You know, people act like when they read about the compromise of 1877 or anything else that white folks put down on paper, that they have the mistaken belief that it's just on paper. No, it's not on paper. It's real. And the reality was, it, back then, and that's why the federal government and the U.S. Justice Department has not really ever defended black people, because in 1877, Samuel Tilden and Rufus B. Hayes entered into agreement that the federal government would take its arms and hands off of black people, and that they would have to now swim for themselves.
So, looking ahead here, let's dismantle some of these things. The prosecutor, what should happen to him?
The prosecutor should be going to jail. I mean, for a number of reasons. First of all, you can't have a grand jury proceeding and then turn around and disclose the evidence. I mean, that's very clear. I mean, every state in the union says, look, if you have a grand jury process, the only way the evidence possibly can be disclosed later is through a judge. But when these people are dealing with, they're not dealing with judges no more. For example, Miss Diallo said that she was raped by this man who had the International Monetary Fund. The grand jury agreed with her and gave an indictment. Cyrus Vance stepped up to the plate and said, no, I'm dismissing the indictment. He can't dismiss the indictment. You know, he can't question credibility. It doesn't work that way. But that's how they operate with us. They're deciding, hey, might makes right. That's what we're dealing with. Might makes right. This is a nation of men and not a nation of laws. And so, therefore, this is what we want to do. This is what we're doing. This man had disclosed a secret grand jury process. It is a felony conviction in itself. It's a felony conviction. And then, to make matters worse, and I don't know what people understand this, but what sometimes we see things, we don't know what we're seeing. You had Bob McCullough come into a room last night and tell the media and the world, this is what my view of what the grand jury did. Well, the problem with that is a prosecutor cannot issue a grand jury report. That's what that amounted to.
Mm-hmm.
That was the statements that he had to make in that press conference amounted to a grand jury report. Only the grand jury can write a grand jury report. Only a grand jury can do that. No prosecutor can do that. That's what Abrams did. He got caught. I got a grand juror who gave me a sworn affidavit. They didn't want to deal with that later. He got caught because that's what he wrote the grand jury report. But this man out in St. Louis did worse than that. He came out and made it clear that, hey, I'm writing this report, and I'm not making any recommendations. Because, you see, once you issue a grand jury report, you're supposed to come up with legislative recommendations.
Correct.
So you can't come out of a grand jury and say, well, this is my view of what the grand jury did, and I'm not making any recommendations. Take it or leave it. Go home. Now, none of this stuff is being mentioned today. I mean, the only time people are going to hear most of this analysis is right here on your program. And these are the things that are happening. I mean, this is outrageous. And to know that we are sending boys to do a man's job doesn't say nothing good about any of us as a people.
What should happen to Darren Wilson?
Well, what I think should happen to Darren Wilson is that he should be arrested. I mean, that's what should happen to him, that he should be arrested. And if nothing else, somebody should make a citizen's arrest. That's what should happen to him. Somebody should make a citizen's arrest and say, we're going to keep him until such time as justice is done in this case. He is not going to sit here, given the fact that probable cause has been established, and he's going to go on vacation with his sweetie. We're not playing that. We're not dealing with boys. You don't tell us that. Probable cause already exists. We already know that. Once probable cause exists, somebody got to get arrested. And if nothing else goes, then it's a matter of self-help. I mean, we have been the real victims of self-help, because there were times when we wished that the mob just took us down to the county pokey and put us behind bars, but we ended up on the wrong end of a string. All right, so self-help is appropriate in this country. Is that wrong with it? Because this country has refused to enact an anti-lynching law. The last time that effort was made to enact an anti-lynching law was by a congressman from Missouri, and that got turned down. So this country has made it very clear that lynching is okay in this country. Our position is, well, we're not going to lynch him, but if lynching is all right in this country, then we certainly can take him to a jail cell and wait and see what kind of bail, if any, that he's going to get, if he's going to ever get back out again.
So as we come to the close of the program, what do you see? I mean, what is your reaction? What is your gut feeling today? We knew that, you know, on the 19th, as I said, we predicted that this is what was going to happen. I told people that. You told people that. And not basically because, you know, there's exceptional brilliance going on here. Well, there kind of is. But because history tells us these things. If you've covered, and I've covered, and in your case, you've litigated these kinds of cases enough to know that when you see the signs, you know exactly where these things are headed. And it's going to hold true in the same, the case in Staten Island, the chokehold case, where a grand jury, a special grand jury, we don't even know what it is supposedly still hearing evidence in that case. But, and of course, they will be looking at the outcome of the Ferguson case. But what as a lawyer, as a person who's dedicated, you know, your entire life to this idea of justice, what do you feel today?
Well, I tell you what I feel, Utrecht, and I think people got to understand this. I'm in the justice business. All right, that's my job. That's what I was sworn to do. That's what I gave up any effort to a lucrative law practice in order to make sure that justice was done. A lot of people in New York have benefited from that in one way or the other. All right, right from the time I came to New York. That when I first got to New York, Utrecht, there were segregated courtrooms in New York. When I first got to New York, there were defendants who was on trial and asked for a glass of water, and court officers would go to the toilet and get a pitcher of water and bring it back to the table. That's where my problem with New York started, because I happen to be the only person that took a position against that. That did not come from the Gang of Four, and we know who that gang is, who tried to disbar me or do anything else. I did all this in spite of black people. All right, not because of them. And so my point is this. If we want to see justice anywhere, then we need to make sure that if there's no other man that's available to do justice, I'm available. You know, I don't have to be the first one out to shoot, but I am available, because this is a disgrace to the entire race. That's what this is. What happened in Ferguson, the fact that our children now got to be in a situation where nobody they can believe in, is a disgrace for every effort of all of our ancestors since we have been in this country. And if we can't get serious now, if we can't make some investments in our liberation, if we can't decide at the worst that I'm going to compensate you for the writings that you do, for the information that you deal, then we are sorry people. All right, it's just that simple. Because there's no way in the world you can say the system doesn't work. No, the system works. It takes somebody who knows how to work the system.
I want to thank you, Alton, for being with us today and for sharing your thoughts and your expertise, as usual, giving insights that are available nowhere else. And they come at great expense, I know, of your own personal and professional sacrifices. So I want to thank you all the more for being so generous with us today.
And I want to thank you again, Eutrice, for the invitation. And I suppose we'll resume this tomorrow.
Yes, we will. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope this puts into perspective what's happening in Ferguson and the Fergusons of America. You would notice that we have been concentrating on the legal aspect of the case, which is really how you understand this case. And this is where I have gone with most all of the cases that I've dealt with. The cosmetic piece and the you know, all of the other incidental information, that's one thing. When you really get to how the law is applied and misapplied, and how these things produce predictable results, the roles that people play in order to produce those predictable results, you get a sense of how systemic the problem is and permanently systemic. This is the problem here. So I want to thank you for joining me today. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You want to stay tuned for that. You can reach me at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D, Stories, plural, at gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Always a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. We'll see you tomorrow.
Bear the courage where we fail. And if I can but shed some light as they carry us through the gate, we who believe in freedom can not live. We who